Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. One of the most beautiful parts of the Sierra Nevada is iconic Lake Tahoe. Known for its crystal clear blue waters and magnificent mountain setting, the lake is one of the crown jewels of California and Nevada. But in an era of climate change and overdevelopment, the lake faces many threats to its legendary clarity. Tahoe is the second deepest lake in the United States and one of the deepest in the world. Fortunately, it's one of the most scientifically studied as well. For over 60 years, starting with the pioneering work of Dr. Charles Goldman, the lake has been intensely studied and monitored by UC Davis through their Tahoe Environmental Research Center located in Incline Village, Nevada. In July of 1997, then-President Bill Clinton and Vice President Al Gore visited Lake Tahoe and, famously clad in khakis and blue shirts, accompanied UC Davis and University of Reno scientists to see the environmental challenges the lake was facing. That led to historic legislation that has literally helped keep Tahoe blue. In this episode of Blue Dot, we'll examine the state of Lake Tahoe from an environmental science perspective with two leaders from the UC Davis Tahoe Environmental Research Center, or TERC for short. Later on in the program, we'll talk to TERC's field lab director and captain of their scientific navy, Michael Kane. But up first, we're joined by Alexander Forrest. Alex is the interim director of the UC Davis Tahoe Environmental Research Center and has specialized in robotics data collection for over 20 years, from the Arctic to Antarctica. He's an expert on water quality and ecosystem health at Lake Tahoe and other Sierra lakes. He joins us now. Alex Forrester, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I see by your title, you're the interim director. Would you like to tell us about a little bit about how you got to have this incredible gig?
Sure. And I've actually been here for a while in a number of different roles. I first came down to Tahoe in 2009 while I was a grad student up in the University of British Columbia, and did a project then. And then came back to do a postdoc once I finished my PhD, and then started at UC Davis in 2016 as a professor and in the Civil and Environmental Engineering program, and playing a role in helping run research projects and education projects out of the center. And I've been doing that for a number of years. And then when the director retired in January of this year, then I took over as interim director. So I've been in this role for a relatively short period of time.
And that was Jeff Schlatto, right?
That was Jeff.
And he was the director for quite a while, wasn't he?
19 years.
Let's talk a bit about the history of, and we should just refer to it by its acronym TERC. Is that okay?
Yeah, TERC works great.
Yeah. It's got a really long and fascinating history. Could you just give us a little capsule version of the history of TERC?
Sure. So the first measurements that Charles Goldman made here were in 1959, when he was coming up from Davis, where he was a faculty member. And he then formally established a research center up here in 67, and this center sort of grew and evolved into the program that we have today. And he made continuous observations here. We have one of the longest continuous observations of lakes in North America. Then in 2004, he ended up retiring, and that's when Jeff Schlatto took over and continued to grow to the center to where we are now.
And it's part of UC Davis, and you have like a little mini campus up there. Tell us a bit about the setting of where that's at and what it's like.
Sure. So we're kind of spread over around the lake. So we're up in the north end of the lake, and we have our main education center, lab facilities, and offices over in Incline Village, Nevada. And there we have about 15 full-time staff work there now. And then we have a variety of students that come up from the UC Davis campus. And then we also have an historic field station. It's a field station that's in an historic building. And that's where, when Charles started, that's where a lot of our center was. And then a lot of our boat operations are done from there in Taos City. And then we have two boats that are moored full time or in a slip full time on the lake. So we're basically out usually about 200 days of the year out on the lake.
Well, let's talk about the lake itself. It's so famous for its beautiful color and clarity. You know, Keep Tahoe Blue is a such a cool bumper sticker. I've had one for many years. But let's talk about why does it look like that? Because it's kind of interesting. Why does Lake Tahoe have that beautiful clear blue color?
Sure. And I'm glad you have a sticker. They're great to have. And it's a great public education campaign. So the blue is, there's really two parts of that question. And the first part is about clarity and basically the cleanness of the water. And then the second part is about the blueness. So to talk about the first part, it's really because of the lack of particles. We have a relatively small watershed compared to the actual size of the lake itself. What that means is we have relatively low amount of water flowing off or down slopes and then into the lake. And in addition to that, the type of rock we have in the area in the watershed is a lot of granite that doesn't have a lot of erosion. And so we have a minimal amount of particles being transported into the water. And so that helps with the clearness. And then with the blueness, it comes down to the amount of algae that's in the water, and so, or lack thereof. So we have very few particles. We have very low nutrients. It's what's referred to in limnology, which is the study of lakes, as an oligotrophic or ultra-oligotrophic lake, which means a lack of nutrients. And so there's very low amounts of algae that are in the water as well. And so with low amounts of algae, basically, we get a very, very good blue color of the water. And so I like to joke around that working in Lake Tahoe is similar to working in a lake of distilled water because it's so pure, so clean that it actually in many ways is better than distilled water.
Wow. Yeah, no, that's very cool. And it's a very deep lake too, isn't it?
So yeah, just about 1500 feet depth. Yeah, it's very deep.
And from your research standpoint, you do near shore, you know, studies of, and research and deep water research. Could you just maybe tell us a bit about the two different forms of research that you do in those different environments?
So I mean, we, as a group, we tackle all kinds of questions from near shore to what we refer to as the pelagic. So the pelagic zone is the area that's offshore, essentially. And looking at those connections of physical processes that cause mixing and redistribution of the particles that are in the water. And so, and then the linkages that the nearshore zone then have to the watershed itself. So we do studies of the forest, the runoff that's coming through the streams, how that's interacting in the nearshore, how that's potentially driving algae formation in the near shore or transport of particles, how that's related to invasive species that are coming in and being reworked and moved around the lake, and then how the processes in the lake and in the pelagic zone then interact with all of these things. So to do that, we do a whole variety of different, we have a whole variety of different sensors that we put out. I've been focusing more and more on real-time networks of instruments that we can basically put at stations in the near shore and we can log on remotely and see that data in real time, because that then helps inform models and trying to understand how the entire system works together.
And you have, if I can use this term, a kind of a scientific Navy operation going there. Could you talk a bit about, you know, the different ways you go about studying the lakes? Let's start with the boats.
Sure. So I kind of laugh at your term of scientific Navy. I like it. I might have to adopt it. But we have a number of different boats that we use, both Lake Tahoe and other lakes around the state that we're doing projects on. We have one, which is basically a mobile lab that we do a lot of chemistry work on. This particular vessel is a bit older. It's a 1976, a converted salmon trawler. And then we have a high-speed boat that we can go out and do very sort of quick deployments of. It helps support our dive team that are diving every month of the year in the lake. But then we also have a whole area of underwater robotics that we're using. And so broadly, these are autonomous underwater vehicles, AUVs for short. And some of them are propelled with a propeller. And that gives us a relatively short time duration of operations. Then we have underwater gliders. We have remotely operated vehicles, so basically vehicles on tethers. We have drones, so we do a lot of air drone work, both on the lake itself, around the near shore. We've recently started working with helicopters, so we're doing helicopter surveys around the lake. And then we also use these drones as well in the forest and trying to understand the health around the lake at the same time.
Yeah, when I was there, spent a couple of summers there in the early 2000s, I remember looking around at the forests surrounding the lake and just noting that they were not healthy, very choked with a lot of debris, and thinking this is a place that's just primed to burn. So I was wondering, you know, what is kind of the state of the forest health around the lake right now in general?
So, I mean, there are many concerns with the forests, and there's a lot of work that's going into prescribed burns and maintenance of fuel that is there in the forests. And there's also a lot of concern with invasive species that are coming down and causing damage to the forest. And so some of our work as a center is looking at basically which trees are potentially resistant or not to different species of beetle or other invasive species that are coming in. But forest management in general is definitely top priority for many different agencies in the basin. The Caldor Fire was front and center for here. I mean, several of our staff were evacuated along with most of the west side of Lake Tahoe when that fire came through. So there's a lot of issues around that that we could probably have a separate conversation with a whole panel of people from the basin.
Yeah, it's a complex issue with a lot of problems and a lot of problematic things that need solutions. Let's talk about the history of the clarity of the lake and in terms of that, because, you know, in the early history of the lake, there was a lot of logging. There were some big fires. Can you talk a bit about how that early history leading up to today and development have kind of, you know, been prime movers in the reduction of the clarity of the lake?
So, to start, in the early days, there was a building boom in the 60s and 70s in Tahoe. And really, people were just developing properties, developing houses, et cetera. And so the use was changing in the basin. And so what our monitoring program showed through time was a slow degradation of the clarity. So basically, how far you could see into the water was decreasing with time. And then Clinton and Gore famously came here in the late 1990s, and there was a photo op where they went out on the boat and they launched a big initiative to try to slow the decline of the clarity. And so they did, and there's been many agencies and folks around the basin involved with this, trying to control the flow of particles coming in from either storm water or properties, or the tributaries and streams coming into the lake to try to stop these particles from getting in. So that's part of the equation. Now, another part of the equation, and kind of linking back to wildfires, is wildfires put out smoke, which the smoke particles get deposited on the lake, and trying to understand that piece of it is something that we've been focused on a lot more recently, because it's these regional scale changes when we have very local conditions where we can change the amount of particles that are coming in, that's one thing that we can do. But if you all of a sudden have a mega fire that's dumping particles from northern Canada into Lake Tahoe, that's a different situation where we're not necessarily responding in the same way. And so trying to understand the processes that bring the particles in, and those are the inorganic particles. Then the other piece of that is that we also have organic particles, basically small phytoplankton, that are in a range of similar size that also cause a reduction in clarity. And so we've been seeing in recent years shifts in the phytoplankton that are in the lake and the different species of phytoplankton that are there. And so as different species are dominating, that will shift both the color as well as the clarity of the lake itself.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Alexander Forrest, Interim Director of the UC Davis Tahoe Environmental Research Center, as we examine the state of the magnificent Sierra Lake. Its maximum depth of 1,645 feet deep make it one of the deepest in the world. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot as we examine one of the bluest parts of our planet, Lake Tahoe. Let's get back to our conversation with Alexander Forrest. Alex is the interim director of UC Davis's Tahoe Environmental Research Center based in Incline Village, Nevada. Are you observing more algae growth, blooms, that kind of thing that we're seeing in a lot of other places because of the warming waters and things like that? What's the state of the algae? Kind of tell us a bit about the stuff that's called periphyton, for example.
So periphyton and metaphyton are the two ones. So basically attached and detached algal growth. And you see this a lot in the near shore. So if you're visiting Tahoe and you wade into the near shore and you see a rock with attached growth, that's what we're talking about. And we are seeing an increase in this. This is partly related to nutrient load. And so the nutrients that are in the water that help, that are changing the conditions. And so you basically have periphyton and metaphyton. And then, but you also have phytoplankton, which is small growth in the rest of the water that's drifting around. And then zooplankton are the small animals that graze on the phytoplankton. So this is all happening concurrently. And to your question of, are we seeing changes? The short answer is yes. And it is related to heat in the near shore and the warmth of the water, it's related to the growing season, and it's related to the nutrients that are coming in.
Well, and of course, those nutrients that we're talking about, they come from runoff, and a lot of that has to do with the development around the lake. One of nature's greatest filters are wetlands, you know, the marshes and meadows that naturally would have surrounded the lake. If we went back, you know, hundreds of years, we would have seen lots of that. What's the state like of the meadows and marshes, the wetlands around the lake, and are some efforts underway to restore some of that?
So there certainly are. I mean, the main inflow to the lake comes in through South Lake Tahoe. And so the Upper Truckee River was flowing, it flows into the lake. And there's been a lot of work in recent years, restoration efforts, to try to improve the condition upstream. And that's something that we're not directly working with, but I certainly, there are agencies and programs in place to try to restore some of that function.
And then another issue, of course, we're hearing about in the oceans and in all of our waterways and everywhere, in our bodies even, is microplastics. Tell us a bit about the problem of microplastics in Lake Tahoe.
So like everywhere else, and we actually do work in Antarctica as well. And I think there's a paper published, just recently where they found evidence of microplastics in snow in Antarctica. So it really is everywhere. So usually, or sometimes we think of microplastics as being small pieces of plastic that are drifting around the water that you can see with the human eye. And there's usually a picture in news articles of somebody holding a handful of plastic. But those are some of the plastics we're talking about. But the plastics we're really concerned about are the very small ones, the ones that you can barely see with the human eye. So less than 5 micrometer. So very, very small pieces of particles, and these that aren't degrading and then accumulate through the food chain. And so whether or not it's, you know, the small organisms that are ingesting them and taking them in and then work their way up through the higher trophic levels, or the plastics that we're ingesting. So we've been involved. And there are different agencies doing work on this in Lake Tahoe. So we're one team that's working on this. And we've been doing a lot of work trying to understand the amount of microplastics that are in the water, trying to characterize them. And then now we're starting to work with drinking water suppliers to try to create more robust monitoring techniques to try to understand the microplastics that are there.
What are some of the ways that Turk goes about educating the public to try to, you know, mitigate some of these problems we've been talking about, like, you know, nutrient runoff and microplastic pollution, you know, recreating responsibly instead of leaving a lot of trash around the beaches?
Yeah, that's a great question. We have a dedicated team for public outreach and education, and we have our education center over in Incline Village. And our education center does an amazing job of bringing students in as well as going out to classrooms. So I think last year our numbers were about 16,000 K-12 kids that we've engaged with either in our center or in their classrooms to try to teach these various things. So we do a huge amount of work doing that to try to educate kids, but also educate adults. So we have a whole program where people can come in and they can get educated on these processes that we're talking about. We've just started doing education as well we're calling them satellite education centers, in the local visitor centers. So we opened our first one over in Tahoe City in March. And then we're planning to open a new one in South Lake Tahoe, as well as one in Kings Beach as well, where visitors coming in to the visitor centers can then start seeing some of the problems and challenges Lake Tahoe faces, and can get involved by getting involved with various agencies, getting educated on what the problems are, and absolutely not leaving their trash on the beach.
The very least we can do.
At the very least.
Yeah. Of course, looming over all of everything that has to do with the environment is the issue of climate change. What are some of the issues that, you know, you've seen and your predecessors have seen in terms of climate change in the Lake Tahoe Basin? And what do you think some of the challenges are for the future?
Well, if I knew that, I was going to say that's the $1 million question, but really that's the $1 trillion question. So climate change is definitely affecting lakes. Whether or not that's Lake Tahoe and changing the temperature, to changing the forest condition so that we're having more and bigger fires. One of the things I think we're seeing a big challenge with, particularly for Lake Tahoe, is this idea of regional problems. And so what I mean by that is, back in the 60s and 70s, when we talked about nutrients and we talked about phosphorus being added because of what we had in soaps, et cetera, or fertilizers, is that we could control it somehow. that we could put in a wastewater treatment plant that could prevent phosphorus from getting, we can remove those nutrients so that it never made it to the lake. So we talk about point sources there. So it's point sources coming into lakes. But now what's happening more and more is this idea of regional scale problems, where it's not just one lake or one point source, but instead it's multiple lakes being affected or an entire state being affected through a single process. So the biggest challenge for us as limnologists is trying to understand how an entire region is changing to make predictions of what's going to happen into the future. And so in terms of looking forward, the challenge then becomes, how do we mitigate those changes? So the first step is, how do we predict what's going to be happening in the future? And that's part of ongoing research. And then how do we future-proof ourselves? And how do we protect these amazing natural resources that we have to both play and work in?
And of course, you get to work in one of the most beautiful places on Earth, a place that, you know, lots of people like to go visit and see. It's just, it's a gorgeous place. What do you most enjoy about your work at Turk, and perhaps the most rewarding part for you?
My wife likes to joke around with me by saying that I spend my career chasing beautiful lakes, because I've done work. I work in Tahoe. I do work in Lake Geneva in Switzerland. I've done work in Northern Canada, so lots of various different places. However, what I really love about it is actually, well, twofold. One, engaging with students and trying to train people up and giving people the experience and love of working in the field. I was trained to do field work and to work in these beautiful places. And I want to give others the same opportunity, where getting students out of the classroom and onto a boat and working directly with them, trying to adapt to whatever the environment throws at you, to try to do really robust science. And that truly for me is the interesting part of it. And to have the support of a team that then supports the whole project to try to tackle these bigger questions, It makes it worthwhile for me.
Well, it's been, you know, a really fascinating and fun to talk to you about this just amazing place, one of the great places on the planet, Lake Tahoe, and the wonderful work that's been done over the decades by the UC Davis Tahoe Environmental Research Center there. So Alexander Forrest, Interim Director for TURC, thanks for joining us and sharing all this with us.
And thank you for the opportunity to talk today.
Thanks to our guest, Alexander Forrest, Interim Director of the UC Davis Tahoe Environmental Research Center. Our next guest is also from the Research Center. Michael Kane is the Field Lab Director and Boat Captain for the research vessel, the John LeConte, named for the physicist and first president of the University of California, who was also the first to conduct clarity research on the lake way back in 1868. Michael joins us now to talk about his work captaining the vessel and the other components of Turk's scientific navy. Michael Kane, welcome to Blue Dot.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Let's talk a little bit first about, you know, how you got to Lake Tahoe. Can you remember the first time you ever saw Lake Tahoe?
I actually do. The first time I saw Lake Tahoe, I came into South Lake Tahoe, crested over and saw the lake, and I was astounded. I didn't realize how big it was and how blue it was and how beautiful it was. I couldn't even believe it. It was probably about 20 years ago. And I've been coming back ever since, and I've obviously fallen deeply in love with the place.
And how did you go from that moment of first falling in love with Lake Tahoe when you first saw it to now being able to go out on the lake and explore it as the captain of the John LeConte?
Well, I feel very lucky to be a part of Tahoe Environmental Research Center, and so that is part of it. I've spent a good part of my career working in environmental research throughout California, but mainly in the Delta. I've worked on a lot of invasive species management and threatened and endangered species conservation type work throughout my career. And when I saw an opportunity to work in some place that I love as much as Tahoe, I jumped on it and applied and ended up living up here.
Very cool. Well, one of the things that fascinates me about Lake Tahoe is it's so unique. And I'd like to have you go into a little bit about the geology of the basin there, because it's quite fascinating. About 2 million years old, it's about the same age as the San Andreas Fault. Tell us a bit about the tectonic setting for Lake Tahoe.
So Lake Tahoe is very unique. It's a massive lake in the High Sierra. And so it's in a very seismically active fault zone in the Sierra, and that lifted up the Sierra Nevada range on the west side of Lake Tahoe, but also it lifted up the Carson range on the east side of Tahoe. But this happened, and it didn't actually create Lake Tahoe. That happened later, and that was through volcanic activity. So Mount Pluto is an extinct volcano, but at one point it erupted. And it basically dammed the valley in between the Carson Range and the Sierra Nevada. And this lava and Lahar mud flow dam created Lake Tahoe. And at one point it was even deeper than it is now, but slowly it has eroded away. And then beyond that, there's been multiple glaciation and ice age periods that have kind of sculpted especially the west shore of the lake into what it is now. So you have Emerald Bay and Fallen Leaf Lake and Cascade Lake. These lakes are all kind of glacial features that created the beautiful landscape that you now recognize as Lake Tahoe.
And of course, Lake Tahoe is, you know, world renowned for its beautiful blue quality, the clarity of the lake. And of course, I've got my Keep Tahoe Blue sticker on my bumper. And I know I see lots of people do. It's such a treasure. You go out and monitor the clarity of the lake on the research vessel that you operate, the Joseph LeConte. Could you tell us a bit about how you go about determining, you know, what's the actual clarity of the lake? Because it's rather straightforward in a way. It's kind of an interesting way of doing that.
Well, we have multiple ways of looking at the clarity of the lake, but the longest method that we have used is called the Secchi disk. And the Secchi disk is essentially like a dinner plate sized white disk that you put a weight on and you lower it down into the water and you watch it. And eventually it disappears. And sometimes it disappears close to the surface, and other times you can't see it when it's really, really deep. And so we lower it down until it disappears and then raise it up until we see it again, and then average those two numbers together. And it actually does a really good job of giving us a sense and an accurate sense of the clarity of the lake. The other ways that we do it are using more technologically advanced methods. So we have something called a CTD, and it's a conductivity, temperature, and depth sensor that also has other measurement tools on it. And one of those is a turbidity sensor, and that sends light through the water and measures the refraction of that light. And that also gives us a sense of how much particulate matter and the clarity of the water as well. And so those are the two of the tools that we use to measure that.
Yeah, and do you remember like what the deepest depth you ever got a Secchi disk measurement for?
The deepest I got was somewhere around 32 and a half meters. It has been lower than that, up down to maybe 40 meters. And when I saw it, it just kept going down and down and down. I couldn't believe that I could still see it. And finally, it barely disappeared. And I was in awe of how beautiful the lake was.
Let's take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our look at the state of Lake Tahoe with Michael Kane, Field Lab Director and Boat Captain for the UC Davis Tahoe Environmental Research Center. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. let's continue our look at the state of Lake Tahoe science with our guest from the UC Davis Tahoe Environmental Research Center, also known as TURC. Michael Kane is the field lab director for TURC and also the boat captain for their research vessels.
We have a couple boats. So we have two boats stationed on Lake Tahoe full time, and that's the John LeConte and the research vessel, the Bob Richards. And the John LeConte we've had in operation since 1976. It's an old salmon trawler that's been outfitted to run all the numerous types of scientific activities that we do on it. We do zooplankton tows, looking at basically the small animal life in the lake. We run all of our Lake Tahoe monitoring programs off of that. And we actually do education tours as well on it. So it's a big boat and it's beautiful, but it's also a little outdated and not very quick. So if there are, you know, afternoon thunder showers coming in, you can't plan to run away from them. You have to not go out on the lake. And so we're actually looking to update that hopefully one of these days. And then one of our other boats is the Bob Richards. And this is a newer vessel. It's great. It's called a landing craft. So you can open the front of the vessel and it comes down to water level. And we use it for diving. And most of our daily activities are conducted off of this boat. And then we also have a fleet of other vessels. So we have three other vessels, one stationed down in Clear Lake almost full time, but we also use it up in Lake Shasta and in other areas. We have one in the Delta that we use. And then we also have a smaller vessel that we keep in our boathouse that we can kind of trail around to where we need it. And then we have a couple kayaks as well, but those don't get used as often. So we definitely have a fleet.
And you also, you deploy submersible vehicles that are autonomous too, don't you?
We do. So we have AUVs, which are autonomous underwater vehicles, and then gliders. And they kind of function differently. Autonomous underwater vehicles, they have a propeller. And that propeller uses a lot of battery power. And so you can deploy them for hours as opposed to days or weeks or months. While the gliders, they use buoyancy and weight distribution to have them glide through the water column. And so if you want it to go north, it would turn a little bit, point north, and then it would dive. So it would put its battery forward, and then it would deflate an air bag. And so it'd be negatively buoyant, and it would glide through the water just based on its weight in the water column. And then eventually it'll get to a certain depth and you would pre-program this and it would actually use buoyancy, so positive buoyancy, to come up in the water column and keep moving forward. And this one, because it's not propelled with a propeller, you can leave it out there for months.
What kind of data do they collect?
It's a lot of the same data that we collect with our CTDs, our conductivity, temperature, and depth sensors. So we can have particle data. We can monitor flow. There's a bunch of different sensors that you can put on this. And depending on the mission that we're trying to accomplish, we adjust it for that mission.
And you also have buoys out on the lake, don't you?
Yeah. So we have four buoys that they're NASA-sponsored buoys, and we help maintain them. These buoys measure a myriad of things, but one of the most important things is it measures the surface temperature of the water of Lake Tahoe, and it uses this measurement to calibrate a lot of the satellite data that's collecting data as it flies over the country. And so these are also something that we work on with NASA.
Very cool. Okay, let's talk about the interesting aquatic food web of Lake Tahoe. It's quite famous for its lake trout and things like that. There's also, you know, a lot of invasive species, like you were talking about earlier, that you've dealt with over the years. Can you give us a basic idea of what the food web like of healthy Lake Tahoe is?
So The food web in Lake Tahoe has changed a lot over the years. It used to be a relatively simple food web where you would have phytoplankton, and think of this as really small plants and algae that photosynthesize, and that's the base of the food web. And then kind of higher up in the hierarchy are the zooplankton, and these are things that feed on the phytoplankton. And then above that, you have fish. And in the lake, it used to have a relatively simple structure in terms of fish, but a lot have been introduced. So the only native salmonid to Lake Tahoe was the Lahontan cutthroat trout. And it has basically been extirpated from the lake. So they've been stocking a few of them in there recently. So there may be a few out there, but all the non-native salmonids have taken over and outcompeted this native species. So we have rainbow trout, Lahontan cutthroat trout, brown trout, brook trout, and kokanee salmon in there. And then on top of that, there's a whole bunch of warm water fish that have been introduced into the system. So there's catfish, bluegill, largemouth bass, and I think goldfish have been found, probably dumped out from people's fish tanks and wow. And who knows what else, but it's definitely a changed ecosystem because of all these introduced species.
What are some of the problems that those fish like bass are causing in bluegill?
Well, one of the problems, especially with the salmonids, is that they are outcompeting that native species, the Lahontan cutthroat trout. You know, they also interbreed, the rainbow trout interbreed with the Lahontan cutthroat trout, so changing the genetic makeup of this species. In terms of largemouth bass and bluegill, they can eat young salmonids, and they really just don't necessarily fit into the ecosystem in a simple way that it was before. They can also adjust, make changes to the zooplankton populations and aquatic invertebrate populations. So it really can have drastic effects on the entire ecosystem.
And something that happened several years ago that's kind of a case in point about all this was the introduction of the mysid shrimp. Could you tell us a bit about that and what happened with those?
Well, so mysid shrimp were intentionally introduced into Lake Tahoe. They were introduced as a source of food for fish. And the goal was to add these shrimp and hopefully increase the amount of food available to the fish so that the people could catch the fish and eat them. However, their population exploded. Maybe they aren't even as good a food source for fish as they originally thought. And it really could be one of the drivers to reduced water clear in the lake by eating different zooplankton or other types of life in the lake and changing the food web.
In your work there on the food web ecology, do you interact a lot with fishing folk to find out, you know, what they're catching and where and why?
I think we have a presence on the lake. It's really great. Everybody is interested in science and they come up and talk to us, and we have a good working relationship with most of the people that we encounter. And so people are always asking us questions or giving us little anecdotal information, and we're always happy to share the science and continue the education in the basin. And so we talk to people all the time. And I love that part of the job, actually.
And of course, you explore Lake Tahoe, you know, as a captain of the boat. Do you have any like favorite places? You know, you don't have to say exactly where they are, but do you have some favorite places where you just love going to this particular spot?
Yeah, I mean, Lake Tahoe is beautiful all around. But there are definitely some places I like more than others. I think one of the luxuries of working for UC Davis and being out on the lake is we go out year round. And so a lot of times I'll be out there in midwinter alone on the lake with the snow covered mountains around, and the water's even clearer in the winter than it is in the summer. And it's just spectacular. And it's really an amazing thing to have that option, which not everybody does. And so one of my favorite places to be is Emerald Bay. Everybody loves Emerald Bay. And I've been out there at night when it's still calm and you can see the reflections of the stars on the water and at night. And it is just so beautiful. It really is.
Yeah. As soon as you said that, I got the image of starlight on the water and just like, oh, that must be spectacular.
And to see a lake as big as Lake Tahoe be just glass, you know, and a mirror is just something that, encourage everybody to take the time to go out at night on a calm day and just see the lake and appreciate it.
Well, on the flip side of that, you know, you in your research, you're out there in all kinds of weather all through the year. What's it like to be out there when things aren't so great? Like when it can be kind of nasty. Have you had some, you know, adventures out there? I'll put it that way, on the lake.
Yeah, definitely. We are out year round and we're diving year round. So when the water temperature is, you know, in the low below, you know, 10 degrees centigrade or in the 30s or 40 degrees Fahrenheit, we're out there in the water surveying for multiple different things, and it can be a little chilly. We don't always love that, but we do it anyways. And then, you know, in the summertime, you get thunderheads and thunder showers coming. So you may be pretty far from the marina, and all of a sudden these big clouds form up and you see lightning in the distance, and you end up tucking tail and heading back to the marina. And then, yeah, sometimes the wind picks up, and I've been out there where it gets a little choppy. And while I don't necessarily get seasick, other people may. And so that can ruin you someone's day as well. So sure. We definitely see it all out there. And the snow, sometimes we're out there even when it's snowing or fog, you know, you get these beautiful clouds over the lake. It really is magical to see it change over the year.
And in your work there for Turk, I'm interested to know what it's like for you, you know, interacting with students and seeing them, you know, see the lake for the first time, for example, you know, to see it for the first time through their eyes. What is that experience like for you?
That's one of my favorite parts about the job is honestly seeing people have ideas and helping them make it reality. You know, we have all these students that are working really hard to become the next generation of scientists and the next generation of experts out here on the lake that really will, you know, keep this movement and momentum that we're started going, and to see them accomplish their goals or to make discoveries is truly inspirational, and I love it. So it's something that I work really hard to help out with, and We have new students coming up all the time, and they obviously love working in Lake Tahoe as well. And just the light in their eyes and the passion that you see is something to behold.
And I bet it's also really rewarding, you know, to think about all of the data that you're collecting and the samples, the water samples, the sediment cores that you collect off the bottom, all of that. And then to see that turned into some, you know, really outstanding research, that must be very rewarding.
It is. And to see how it affects change in the basin, that's also important. You know, we can research something, but then to see how that research influences policy or affects the people around the lake and how they perceive what they could do to help alleviate the problems. Those kinds of things are really meaningful as well.
Oh, certainly. And then lastly, before we let you go, when you look at all of the issues confronting Lake Tahoe, you know, there's the development, wildfires, climate change. What are the things that make you actually hopeful for the future of keeping Lake Tahoe blue?
I guess over the years, I've worked for multiple state agencies, and now I work here at UC Davis. And I've seen so many positive changes happen over the last few decades. And, you know, it's not all positive, obviously, but there's so much effort going into it, you know, whether it's Caltrans taking the time to put in sediment traps to keep certain things out of the lake, or building, you know, wetlands that help filter the water before it comes into the lake, to reforestation practices, to just the work that goes into protecting the lake from invasive species and the clean drain and dry program. All these things that we as a society have kind of taken on and prioritized, I see that as making a big difference. And I think moving forward, we're doing the best we can. We're not perfect, but we're definitely doing the best we can in keeping Lake Tahoe as beautiful and as inspirational to everybody in the future as well.
Well, Michael Caine, captain of the John LeConte and the Turk Navy, I really appreciate you spending your time with us and sharing your love for Lake Tahoe and the research you're doing there. It's really, really cool to hear about.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the time and talking. It was great.
Thanks again to our guests from the UC Davis Tahoe Environmental Research Center, Interim Director Alexander Forrest, and Field Lab Director and Boat Captain Michael Caine. You can learn more about the work being done at Turk and how you can visit and become involved at their website, tahoe.ucdavis.edu. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fiddler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.